It's hard to believe that this month marks 20 years since Hurricane Katrina slammed southeast Louisiana and the Mississippi coast with the costliest disaster in U.S. history. On this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, Dr. Alessandra Girolaman, Director of Research at the Center for Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, shares her personal Katrina story and gives us insights about how to better prepare for extreme weather events in the future. Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast, where we explore the world to bring you stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. This podcast starts with a challenge. I am daring you to like, subscribe, and follow our podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Your support of the podcast helps us mark professional progress, enabling many more episodes of the GeoTrek podcast in the future. Without further introduction, let's jump into this episode of the GeoTrek podcast with Dr. Alessandra Girolaman. I think you're going to love this episode because Dr. Girolaman not only shares professional insights about how to make our communities more resilient, but she also reflects on her personal experiences in Hurricane Katrina 20 years ago. Alessandra, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a part team director of research at the Center for Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University in New Orleans, Louisiana. Could you tell us a little bit about this exciting work that you and your team are doing?
I'd be happy to. I run a community-based participatory research lab. And so the law students and also some master students pair up with communities that are looking at issues and questions related to disasters, the environment, related to climate, and in particular that have a law, a policy, a regulatory component, which of course is everything. And they really learn how to co-design questions and apply their particular skills to the things that are rising. And for me, I've been doing work in Louisiana over 20 years. So this really builds on a lot of the relationships that I had and my prior work as a social scientist before I added the law degree to the mix later on.
Well, that's fascinating. It seems very multidisciplinary there. And also, I know in South Louisiana, people get very passionate about the environment. It seems like some of the projects and studies you're doing are very applied.
Absolutely. They're all 100% applied. The kinds of questions that come up for us are, for example, what does it look like to increase representational sovereignty around disaster for folks so they can tell their own story? And what does it mean when they can and they can't? What does it mean for hyperlocal planning efforts to be able to be visible and legible at different levels of government? Because we know that so much of emergency management starts and ends very, very locally. It's a wide range of issues, all very interdisciplinary. And I love it. I learn something new every semester.
I want to touch on something you just said. You mentioned the importance of people developing their own story. Why is that so important?
Well, we have a great example, actually, with Hurricane Katrina, where there were sort of competing narratives. On the one hand, you have folks who live in Louisiana, see the value of the coast for its beauty, for its environment, for its economic functions, for the history of the place. And then you also have this competing narrative of why on earth would somebody live there, right? This place that always floods. And which of those narratives sort of wins out, or at least how those narratives get heard or don't in a national conversation, has a lot to do with the kinds of resources that places get, and also with people's own mental health in a community that's trying to recover and either feeling supported or feeling as though they're being looked down upon by the rest of the country.
Alessandra, what a great example. We know Katrina was very complex, very high profile event. And, you know, this month, getting into August, when this will air, it's the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Could you share with us your Katrina story? I mean, where were you when Katrina hit, and how did the storm impact you personally and professionally?
Absolutely. It's hard to believe it's been 20 years, and I now have students sometimes who weren't even alive at the time of Hurricane Katrina. When the storm hit, I was actually living in Araby, which is in St. Bernard Parish, not too far away from the Lower Ninth Ward for folks that aren't from the New Orleans area, might recognize that reference at least. I was not physically here in person during the storm. I was actually out of town. I was up in New York visiting some friends, and I wasn't working in emergency management at the time. But as folks might recall, the storm sort of shifted, right? So initially, we sort of thought that it was going to be more of a problem for Florida. And then it turned out that it was going to be a problem for Louisiana, and folks were sort of scrambling to make plans and evacuate. And I was already out of town, and it's quite difficult to actually come back in time to then evacuate. And, you know, and if folks are wondering why you'd want to come back, if you think about the things you do or don't take with you when you're just going away for a weekend, I didn't have my passport, for example. I didn't have my computer at the time. I think nowadays we've all learned from the storms and things are easier to carry. But at that time, you know, that was sort of all happening. And Hurricane Katrina, in many ways, really changed my life trajectory. I had been working on a master's in public administration and really interested in working with communities, with schools, with children on the different things that matter to folks to be more resilient, to thrive. And in Louisiana, that always included thinking about disaster. So that was sort of on my radar. And I was at the University of New Orleans, so I knew folks working in emergency management and was even occasionally getting these little nudges of, why don't you come work with us? And then, of course, Hurricane Katrina happened, and it was very clear very quickly that we needed to be asking some of these bigger questions to even begin to get at what it means to be able to grow and thrive as, for example, a child in New Orleans. And so through a combination of losing my home, my job, my car in the span of 24 hours, and the fact that these other opportunities were there and interested me, I ended up doing something entirely differently than what I had thought I would do.
Alessandra, I want to touch base with you on these lessons learned, on these different questions we're asking on the work. But before we get to that, could you just share with us for a moment, at some point you had to get back to St. Bernard Parish. I mean, what was that like walking down your street and coming to your house where you said you lost your home, you lost your car? I mean, this is highly personal at that point and a tremendous loss in your life.
It was very difficult, as I think it is for everyone. And I can't imagine for folks who had lived there their whole life, had childhood memories, what that must have been like. I was a recent transplant. I was very young, recently married, and did not really have, you know, that same sort of accumulation of life things, although certainly I had an accumulation. And coming back to the house was a sort of very surreal process where you had to go through checkpoints. You were only able to be there during daylight. There's always a little bit of nervousness around knowing what to expect. You know, might there be snakes? What contaminants are in the water? And I personally had not wanted to go back so quickly. A lot of folks did. They wanted to rescue pictures. They wanted to do all of these things. I really didn't want to see it. But as a result of insurance needing particular documentation and the mortgage company needing particular documentation, after being on the phone with the adjusters who said it wasn't safe enough for them to go, I had to go and take pictures. And you couldn't actually get into the home other than by crawling through a window. It was as though somebody had picked up the house, filled it with mud, and shaken it like some sort of horrible snow globe. And I had a lot of books. I love reading. And I was, you know, just finishing college. So I had a lot of books in, you know, these really inexpensive sort of particulate bookshelves that a lot of people have. And all of that had turned into mush. I mean, there must have been about a foot and a half of sticky, gooey, papery mush, like a school project where you learn how they used to make papyrus, right? It was sort of like that, if anybody has that kind of memory from elementary school. And nothing was really salvageable. And the whole house had torqued. You could tell from looking up in the rafters that the house was structurally unsound.
I really appreciate you sharing those personal stories and very graphic stories. I know a lot of people, when they think of a flood, they're just thinking water comes in and out almost like swimming pool water or Caribbean aqua water. You're describing it's just filled with contaminants and mud and muck. And it would just be almost obviously a very long road to recovery and just an impossible situation to live in those conditions.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that when we've seen, for example, after Hurricane Laura, you know, folks having to live in barely gutted homes for long periods of time waiting on insurance, that I really think about how particularly awful that is and how unhealthy that is for folks. Water is full of contaminants. You get sewage, you have, you know, different things from spills, oil coming out of the cars, and water sometimes moves through pretty quickly, but at other times it also sits, and that creates its own kinds of problems. And so, of course, with the levees in Louisiana and New Orleans, what we had was a situation where in many places, not only did the water come in sometimes quickly, but then it sat.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. I think that helps us to try to get a picture of what people were dealing with there on the ground. Alessandra, as you look back at Katrina, in your perspective, what's the biggest lesson that we've learned from this storm?
So emergency management, I think, has a bit of a fascination with lessons learned. And there's, of course, a good reason for that. We want to learn from previous events. But oftentimes what we end up studying in the field is the lessons that don't get learned. And so it's always a bit of a mixed bag. I think in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, we certainly saw a lot of changes. And some of those did reflect learning, right? For example, we saw vast improvements in the maintenance and operations of the levee system, right? We realized that really this is something that needed to be much more professionalized because it was very existential to the future of New Orleans and the surrounding areas. We also were faced very directly with the horrendous loss of life and the impacts of the failure to evacuate everyone and or sort of shelter them safely. And I think at least in the immediate aftermath, there were a lot of lessons that were learned from that. And sort of a larger lesson is this really being able to acknowledge risk, right? I think for folks that live in New Orleans, it has become more difficult to think of hurricanes as something that isn't that bad, isn't that likely. But as time passes, that's going to change, right? When I first moved to New Orleans, older folks would talk about older hurricanes, right? Folks had memories of, for example, Betsy. And the assumption was if an area didn't get impacted by Betsy, it was sort of safe. I suspect that I'm not that far from being the older person sitting in the chair talking about Katrina to folks for whom it's just not real.
I see what you're saying. Like sometimes we're hearing maybe the older generation say, hey, if you didn't flood in this storm, you're okay. And it's these storms. But as you mentioned, more and more population, we have younger folks that don't remember Katrina or even transplants, right? We have a lot of people moving to Gulf Coast counties and parishes that have never been through anything remotely like a Katrina, right?
We absolutely do. We've had a lot of population shift. And across the nation, actually, we've seen what's been termed the aging of the coast, right? A lot of folks wanting to retire to coastal areas. So it's not just younger folks. Sometimes it's folks that have grown up in areas that were not exposed to storms and are now retiring on fixed incomes and are really having to deal with a different and a new kind of risk that they're not entirely prepared for.
Mm-hmm. Alessandra, looking at, say, Metro New Orleans, how would you say the Metro is better prepared for a major hurricane strike today compared to 20 years ago? And then in what ways could we see actually even greater risk today than we did before when Katrina hit?
We have a tendency to learn from what we know, to learn from the events that we've seen. So if we had a storm that sort of mirrored the parameters of Katrina in some way, we do have better plans now to, for example, evacuate folks. And we even have slightly better plans to make sure that there are some resources in place if the city ends up needing to have a shelter of last resort. That's still very murky, not finalized, and problematic, but there is more of that conversation than there was before. And by that same token, we have seen a lot of other organizations and entities in the city, and by that I mean not your usual suspects for emergency management, but folks that work in the nonprofit sector, community-based organizations. We've seen the sort of greater understanding that resiliency is sort of all of our problem, right? And so I think there's more efforts to do things like have the community lighthouses where some churches and other community spaces have access to solar power to help folks after a storm be able to charge their batteries or help them in case of high heat. So we have improvements in some of that coordination. We've seen growth in mutual aid. But, and this is a rather large concern, we also see changes in the parameters of the storms. And so we are seeing now rapid intensification pose a really substantial challenge where sometimes we're going to have storms like Hurricane Zeta a few years ago, where there's not really an option other than to stay in place and hope it moves through quickly, does minimal wind damage, and doesn't dump a lot of rain. And so that's one big shift. The other thing we've seen is that the changing costs of insurance, both flood insurance and homeowners insurance, has left people a lot more vulnerable after a disaster. And so we already know that after Katrina, for example, insurance policies are never enough. Certainly mine weren't. But it's even worse to not have them at all. And it's just become so unaffordable that we're seeing more and more persons without those policies. The other thing that is changing is the federal emergency management landscape. And we don't yet know exactly how that's changing, but we do know that post-disaster recovery, post-disaster resourcing would look very different today than it might have looked 5 years ago.
Alexandra, you mentioned better plans or at least conversations about some of these different planning options, including potential locations for refuges of last resort. Have you seen any conversations talking about vertical evacuations? I mean, we've heard things like you may need 60 or 72 hours to really evacuate the metro. Like you mentioned, with rapidly intensifying hurricanes, what if we have a hurricane, maybe similar to Ida back in 2021, that just blows up right before landfall? We can't get people out. Has vertical evacuation been talked about as a refuge of last resort, or at least a legitimate secondary plan to get people up if they can't get out?
I'm not aware of substantial planning by the city itself in that regard, but I will say that we have seen sort of a shift in the way some of the larger, taller buildings are used in the city. So, for example, after Hurricane Laura, we housed evacuees from Southwest Louisiana in hotels here in New Orleans. And certainly those were folks that then sheltered in place when we saw other storms. And there's some safety, I suppose, in being on higher ground, but there are a lot of other challenges that remain. Right? If, for example, buildings are islanded, you're surrounded by water, you're still looking at needing to assist folks in leaving. We're seeing more prolonged power outages. When you can't use elevators, that's very problematic for anybody with access and functional needs. And actually, you know, Hurricane Ida is unfortunately also an example of some of these concerns, because even though we didn't see as much of an impact in New Orleans as Pointe-aux-Chenes, where the hurricane made landfall, saw, what we did see is a sustained power outage that proved deadly for some folks because of the heat.
Yeah, sometimes we look at these complex hazards with the wind followed by heat, things like that can get surprisingly deadly. Alessandra, when we chatted by phone, you mentioned that there are really two sides to the story about increased flood protection like levees. There are advantages, but also some concerns and disadvantages. What are the two sides to this story, and why is this important?
We often have this assumption that the best option in any place that's flood prone is to sort of figure out how to keep the water out, these large engineered solutions like levees. And certainly levees can play an important role in flood protection. But levees do also sometimes cause harm. One example that is very much front of mind for folks in New Orleans is the levying of the Mississippi River, where, of course, as a result of changing the natural behavior of the Delta, we've seen more land loss than we would otherwise have seen. And we also see all of that nutrient matter coming from the headwater from farms going into the Gulf and creating the dead zone that hurts fisheries and has other impacts. So levees have impacts on the natural environment. In addition to that, however, if you look at Hurricane Katrina itself, the characteristics of flooding following a levee breach are very different from the characteristics of, for example, the bowl filling from surge or just from the accumulation of rainwater. And so when levees fail, the kinds of impacts that people see can be very different than if the levees were not there. But perhaps what sociologists have most concerned themselves with, not just in New Orleans, but across the country where levees have been used, is what's been termed the levee effect. And so some folks have studied what happens when a community obtains levees. And after the 27 flood, right, we started seeing more levees popping up across the nation, and we've continued to construct levees. And one of the things that happens is that more people live in the floodplain. And in fact, that combination of flood protection through vehicles such as levees and the federal subsidies on flood insurance is sometimes sort of credited or blamed with increasing a lot of slab on grade construction in floodplains, which is more prone to flooding. And so sometimes levees as an engineered structure can give us sort of a false sense of security, when in fact, you know, if you're standing at the base of the levee by the Mississippi River, you're looking up at this large wall, but the water is much higher than your head in some cases. And we don't necessarily think about that
Yeah, those are such valuable insights. Like you said, it could give people a false sense of security, but in a sense, their home could be far underwater. They just can't see it because the water's on the other side of the levee or flood barrier, right?
Absolutely. And the other thing that I think we always need to consider when we think about any sort of engineered or, you know, man or person made design, right, is that we construct to a design level. And certain industries, engineering, for example, architecture, will actually put a buffer on top of that, right? We try to sort of design to maybe slightly higher winds than we're seeing now, right? Or we try to design for a little more ground shake than we might expect. But as conditions change and as we have to take into consideration things like cost, those design levels can get exceeded. Bridges, for example, get to the end of their useful life, and we see bridge disasters. Levees get overtopped. Storm surge gets higher, right? We've seen also with tornadoes, more EF5s. And so we always have to be cognizant that anything that is engineered up to a particular level. And when that level's exceeded, it's going to fail.
Alessandra, that's a really good point, right? Because at some point on this planet, we have to accept some level of risk. We cannot protect against every possible scenario. It sounds like you're saying whether it's wind, flooding, whatever it is, there's a design threshold and that can be exceeded.
Absolutely. And we have seen a lot of growth in strategies such as living with water or green infrastructure, right? Trying to do some measure of climate adaptation or hazard risk reduction that acknowledges the existence of the hazard and involves a little more give and take, right? So what can we sort of do, perhaps sometimes to also modify our own behavior, our own building practices? And that is something that historically was done. I mean, certainly, you know, indigenous communities and in many other spaces, there's long histories of sort of living with and interacting with nature. But even in New Orleans, if you look at our iconic infrastructure, if you look at sort of the historic buildings, most of those in neighborhoods such as the Broadmoor neighborhood that flooded were actually built with some elevation. They were built with the understanding that you might see some flood water. And often they were built with materials that could be aired out afterwards, such as the, you know, the board houses along the river that could inundate and not be as likely to grow mold.
No, fantastic perspectives there. And it reminds us all to consider building in buffers, right? Building maybe a little bit higher than required. Things like this, water levels can always be exceeded. And like you mentioned, with rapidly intensifying hurricane, heavier downpours, it doesn't hurt to build a buffer nowadays. Hey, Alessandra, we're actually at our favorite recurring segment of the podcast called Weathered Wisdom. So this is our segment where we ask each guest to share about a weather event that's left a deep impression on you personally or professionally. So this could be something you saw that was shocking or surprised you that Mother Nature could do such a thing. But basically, what is a weather event that impressed you so much it'll stick with you forever?
It's very easy to default to Hurricane Katrina, but I'm not going to. I'm going to give a different example, and that is the 2011 super outbreak. This is the tornado outbreak in April across much of the Southeast and other areas that caused a really substantial loss of life and a lot of damages. And at the time, I was working with Save the Children and doing work around helping emergency management sort of better interact with childcare, with schools, and so on. And of course, with tornadoes, one of the things we worry about a great deal is what happens when children are in schools. But what really struck me about that particular outbreak is that it was this very interesting moment in time for forecasting, where the National Weather Service had really seen a lot of improvements in tornado forecasting. And it was a very well forecasted event. The warning time that folks had was higher than it had historically been. The accuracy of the forecast was much improved. And yet there was still a lot of loss of life. And this didn't just strike me, because the National Weather Service and other folks started to convene emergency managers, community leaders, and something was born out of that, which was referred to as the Weather Ready Nation Initiative, that really came from this understanding that it's not enough to forecast it well. We also need to make sure that it's communicated well, that it's heard, that people are able to act, right? And that comes to a lot of things. The Weather Service worked on really strengthening relationships with emergency managers. FEMA and the federal government worked on trying to bring in resources so there could be greater access to safe rooms for folks. It was a combination that I think yielded good results, but I think it's also really informative for this moment in time, where if we sort of think about that ecosystem of what are all of the pieces that need to be in place so we minimize loss of life, impacts, pain, suffering, trauma from these events that are going to keep happening, right? Some piece of that is the science, right? How are we working on improving forecasting? There's some concerns right now with some of what's happening there. Some piece of that is the relationships. Are there people at the state, at the county, at the parish, at the agencies, at universities, in leadership in the communities that know each other, have had time to talk to each other, are going to be in touch with each other when the water's rising quickly? And we know that it's much easier to build those relationships on a sunny day, right? There's a sort of expression emergency managers use that you don't exchange business cards, right, at the emergency operations center or at the fire. Hopefully this has happened before. But I think it was also a really important moment for folks to think about the value of social science and really trying to understand not just the physical parameters of events, but how people and societies react and respond.
Such important perspectives on that, both in the relationships and the networking, organizations working together. But as you said, you could have a near perfect forecast, and if it's not communicated well with the public, it doesn't do any good. I really am glad to hear that some good initiatives came out of that event. I remember that event well. I was living in Baton Rouge at the time, and really from South Louisiana through South Alabama, just very catastrophic impacts from those tornadoes. Thank you for sharing that. On this podcast, we love to go deep on these topics of weather forecasting and communication and preparedness. How can we be better prepared? That's a very vivid and applicable example, and thank you for sharing that with us. So, Alessandra, going back to wrapping up the podcast and talking about Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans, as we look towards the future, what do you think the path is to better protect New Orleans and vulnerable communities in the Gulf region? I mean, where do we go from here, really?
One thing that I very much believe we need to do is to step back from thinking about disasters as discrete events, as something that happens in a vacuum, and to really think about this moment of time that we're in, where we're seeing back-to-back events, we're seeing cascading events, right? I think it's 2020 that we had 8 near landfalls along the coast, and the Emergency Operations Center in New Orleans was activated, I think, for over a year, dating back to the Hard Rock building collapse, if folks remember when that happened, and then through Mardi Gras, because, of course, large events also activate the Emergency Operations Center. And it was just very, very exhausting for folks. So I think if we can move to where we recognize that there is risk sort of at all moments, and it's not here's our flood risk, here's our hurricane risk, here's our high heat risk, but how do we sort of think of these things together? And also think about how able individuals, community organizations, local government really is to just make it through the day to day, much less than be able to also be prepared, be resilient in the face of an event. And so as we worry more right now about things like access to healthcare, food security, right, ability to pay for insurance, these are all things that are going to impact what happens to a person, a family, a community in a disaster. And we in emergency management love to talk about preparedness, and it is ideal for folks to have on hand their important paperwork, food, water, be able to sort of fend for themselves for an immediate period of time. But some people don't have enough food for today. And so to really be able to be prepared is just about impossible. And it's sort of like that 2011 tornado outbreak scenario, right? It's one thing to say you need to take shelter. It's another to have shelter.
It sounds like your perspective is very holistic, just having communities prepared on the daily and working with emergency management. And like we've seen in a city like New Orleans, it's a great point. Not only do we have hurricanes and floods, but we have Mardi Gras and Super Bowls and these events that bring in millions of people. So it seems like preparedness is really something that has to happen all the time.
Absolutely. And I think people spend more time preparing than they believe they do, right? Most individuals sort of make risk decisions every day. Do you bring sunscreen if you're going someplace? What level of insurance do you keep on your car? Do you ask your child's school or an assisted care facility that a loved one is at whether they have an evacuation plan, right? There's always little things that people are doing and thinking.
Yeah, no, that's a great perspective. Every time we get in the car, we buckle up, right? These things we don't even think about. They're subconscious, but we are preparing ourselves as best we can throughout our days. I love this conversation. I felt like our listeners, I know, are really going to enjoy hearing from you and your perspectives. I know a lot of our listeners are going to want to look you up and your team to figure out how can they learn more about the excellent work you're doing there in Loyola and the city of New Orleans. How can people find you and your team online if they want to learn more?
Thanks for asking. Loyola does have a website for the Center for Environment, Land, and Law, and my contact information is available there. Also have a LinkedIn page, and to be honest, I'm pretty easy to Google and pop up with an email and a phone number.
Alessandra, thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast. As we wrap up, what is one final take-home point you'd like to share with our listeners?
I hope that as folks are looking back on the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, that folks are holding some hope for the future. It's a difficult thing to have these anniversaries for a lot of folks who have been through these events, and also for first responders and emergency managers who sort of watch these things happen over and over and over. But we do have a strong community. We have a strong culture of mutual aid, not just here in New Orleans, but across the country. And so I hope that folks will focus on those pieces as well as sort of the concern about, you know, whatever will or won't happen with this hurricane season and forecasting and funding and everything else.
Sure. Well, personally, I hope we never in our lifetime see anything close to the magnitude of a Hurricane Katrina. But if we do, I know you and your colleagues are making a big difference there in New Orleans and are going to do everything you can to benefit the city. Thank you again, Alessandra, for taking time to come on the podcast. And we look forward to following you professionally in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gerolamin, for sharing these stories and insights with us. I really got three take-home points from this podcast episode. Number one, I so much appreciated that Dr. Gerolamin shared her Katrina story. When you hear these heartbreaking stories of people going back and finding out that they've lost everything, and Dr. Gerolamin described this in great detail. She mentioned she had to enter her home through a window. And then she said it was as if someone took a snow globe full of mud and shook it up. She pretty much lost everything. It's hard to imagine that, but I think these personal narratives are so important. A lot of times we think of flooding just as water coming in and out of a home, leaving some minor water damage behind. Dr. Gerolamin described a world where everything was covered in mud and pretty much lost. All of her books, all of her possessions. It just makes you really take yourself there and imagine what it would be like to lose everything in a community where everyone lost everything. It's almost hard to comprehend. And I really appreciated this personal perspective on her Katrina experience. Number two, Dr. Gerolamin shared about the levee effect, this concept where we think of levees and flood protection as good things. They're going to protect our communities from flooding. But there are several other angles to this that cause concern. Number one is a lot of people get drawn to live behind a levee, feeling that it's a safe place, but it still is a disaster-prone community. She made a good point that sometimes we're actually increasing the population that's at risk by building levees and by people moving in unaware that they also could flood, even though they're behind a levee. And number two, she mentioned the force of water if a levee fails. She mentioned that in the New Orleans area, where much of the land is below sea level, we think of it sometimes filling up like a bowl. But when a levee breaks, it's a massive wall of water that can just rage through a community. I actually did my master's and PhD degrees at Louisiana State University. I remember visiting parts of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and seeing whole communities where all the buildings are gone because a levee broke right next to them. The force of water from a broken levee is just tremendous and can do much more devastation just than water rising vertically. So I thought that was a really good thing that she mentioned about what we call the levee effect. And number three, I was amazed by her story with where she shared about her weathered wisdom. I was surprised. I thought she was going to go with the Katrina story, but she shared about the 2011 severe weather outbreak And what stood out to me about this, she mentioned this was a time when the National Weather Service forecasts were getting more and more accurate. They very well forecast this severe weather outbreak in 2011 in the southeastern states. Unfortunately, we still had a very large loss of life. Dr. Girolamin made the point that it's not enough to accurately forecast the weather. We also have to clearly communicate it and reach the public, reach the audience. If we don't communicate that message, we still see a large loss of life or a lot of destruction to property. I think that's such a timely message and something we talk about a lot on the GeoTrek podcast. We focus a lot on the importance of clear weather communication when it comes to extreme weather events. Thank you so much, Dr. Girolamin, for coming on the GeoTrek podcast and sharing your Katrina experiences and also some very valuable insights about how to be better prepared for natural disasters in the future. This was actually the first of a two-part series looking back at Hurricane Katrina. We're going to feature what you could call a weather celebrity on the second episode, a companion episode here with Katrina, looking back in time. Who is that celebrity going to be? It's a very well-known person in the weather community, and you can find out who that's going to be and exactly when that second episode launches by liking, subscribing, and following us on social media. You'll keep up to date with all of the updates on the podcast so you don't miss out on any future episodes. Special thanks as well to our production team. Jeremiah Long is the senior video producer. He's doing all the magic behind the scenes to make the podcast look so awesome. And of course, Seneth Baker, the president of Blue Leopard Agency. They're the agency behind the production and marketing of the GeoTrek podcast. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Hopefully we don't see anything like a Hurricane Katrina in the near future. But if we do, you're going to be better prepared by listening to experts like Dr. Alessandra Girolamin. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast. And again, next time we'll go back to Katrina for a second part where we look at a different angle of what happened during Katrina 20 years ago. I'm Hurricane Hal, the host of the GeoTrek podcast. We'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.